The Making Of is sponsored by Missoma.
Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Missoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Missoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Missoma.com.
Welcome to The Making Of, a podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. The highs, the lows, the life lessons, but I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is Ruby Bridges. In 1960, Ruby made history when, at age 6, she was the youngest black student to integrate an all-white school in the American South.
I had already been at the White House years before under the Clinton administration because I had received the Presidential Medal. So, you know, it was
nothing new for you.
Nothing new. And then I get there and, you know, the door opens and he walks through the door and then it hit me that, oh my goodness, he's black. There's a black man in the White House and he is president.
The image of Ruby walking to school, escorted by 4 federal marshals, while a white mob shouted insults at her, became world famous. She became a symbol of the human rights movement, but there was an unimaginable impact on Ruby's childhood. We spoke about the moments that made her in a conversation that really took my breath away. So, here we go. Ruby Bridges, welcome to the Female Lead Podcast. We're going to talk about the moments that have made you, chosen by you. And these are some pretty enormous moments. I would say they haven't just made you, they've made all of us. So we are honored.
Thank you so much for having me. I am truly excited.
So the first moment is in 1960, being selected to go to an integrated white Southern elementary school. So just to kind of give us some background on that, you were born in Mississippi and then moved to New Orleans. And this was in the late 50s, in the middle of the civil rights emergence.
Absolutely. I was born in 1954, which is the same year of the landmark case Brown versus the Board of Education. And I was living in a small town, Tylertown, Mississippi, right after my father had come home from the Korean War. And they moved from Mississippi to New Orleans, which is still home for me, and where this whole incident took place. So I actually started school, kindergarten, in 1959 at an all-Black school, because the law, even though the law had passed, it had not been yet implemented in some of those Southern states. And so now here it was in 1960, they were spearheading this movement to make sure that that law was implemented in Louisiana.
And what was life like in the South at that point in Louisiana?
Well, first of all, we were separated by race in schools. I lived in a community where everybody on my street pretty much was Black. Lots of Black families with lots of kids. My cousins lived a couple of doors down, but then the street over could have been a white community. So even though we were nearby, we were still separated by race. My parents, coming from rural Mississippi, they were sharecroppers, meaning that if they had to get the crops in, then they were not allowed to attend school. So school was really a luxury for them that they really could not afford. And I think that that helped to encourage them to enroll me into this integrated school because they wanted opportunities for their kids that they could not have.
So there was a request from the NAACP to take part in this program to get children to integrate into schools. And that's how you were selected. Can you explain a little about how that worked?
Well, what happened is the NAACP was definitely the organization going across the South and making sure that Brown versus the Board was implemented in Southern cities. So once they got to New Orleans, they did a door-to-door search, going into communities and asking families if they had six-year-old kids, would they be willing to sign their six-year-old kids up to attend these integrated schools. There were only two schools chosen in a certain part of the city, which is where I lived. It's called the Lower Ninth Ward, which has been made so famous because that's where Hurricane Katrina hit. And the whole world watched that unfold. So anyway, I lived in that community. And so my parents were one of almost 150 families that actually signed their kids up. They were looking for six-year-old kids because they wanted to start with first grade. I don't know if you remember, but in 1957 in Little Rock, Arkansas, is where high school students integrated. And that was before I integrated in elementary. So nearly 150 families signed up. The opposition said that each kid had to be tested to make sure that they were smart enough to go to these newly integrated schools. And so I remember taking that test. Out of 150 families, only six kids passed the test. Those six kids were divided up between the two schools. Three were assigned to one school and three to the other. And a couple of days before it was time to go, two of the kids dropped out. Their families decided not to send them. And those two kids were actually assigned to go to school with me. And so that is how I ended up in one of the schools alone.
Right. Gosh. And your parents, they wanted you to do it, but your mother was slightly more, she was more keen on you doing this and your father less so. Do you remember
anything about that? My father, having fought in the Korean War, he would often say that even on the battlefield, you could be fighting for the same country right next to a white soldier. If you lived at the end of the day, you could not go back to the same barracks and you could not eat in the same mess hall. And that made him feel like, you know, he was still just a colored soldier. And so even after returning home, a war hero, because he was awarded a Purple Heart for bravery, he still was treated like a second class citizen. And that was not able to get work. And so he felt like, why subject his child to this? Because what he went through did not change anything. And my mother was, you know, she was different. And I often say she didn't have the same experience as my father. She was more for my going than my father was.
Right. And what was her belief in you going, do you think?
I don't know. I just think that instinct to want your kids to have better than you, they had very different experiences. And I just think my mom just really wanted something that she could not.
Did she know that you were going to be the only Black child going to that elementary school?
I think after she realized that only six kids passed, and then a few days before it was time to go, that two of the kids were not going to attend, definitely she knew then. She was encouraged and asked not to take me out. She knew that I was going alone at that point, but that was only a couple of days before it was time to go. She just decided to stick to her decision.
She must have been a brave woman.
She was, but I also believe that there were lots of information that they did not have, and probably some information that they would not have been privileged to. So I think that they were aware that there would be some trouble because federal marshals showed up that were assigned to escort us. But I do not believe that she expected to see what she saw once she arrived there.
And that takes us onto your second moment, which is the first day of elementary school in November 1960. So this is your very first day walking in by yourself. It's an, well, not by yourself, escorted by US Marshals, but this is just a huge iconic moment. We've all seen it. What do you remember from that day?
Well, you know, being six, it also, you know, I'm a parent myself now, and I often think about how hard that would have been to explain to your six-year-old what they were about to venture into. And therefore, my parents did not explain it to me. So I knew that I was going to go to a new school. I wasn't aware that it was going to be a white school. I really did not know who the four very tall white men were. They did say US Marshals, but that really meant nothing to a six-year-old. I really thought that once I turned the corner and saw these mobs of people standing out in front of the school, I was accustomed to Mardi Gras, which is a huge celebration here in the city. And that's actually what it looked like to me. I thought that we had stumbled into a Mardi Gras parade, when indeed it was much different from that. All of the parents showed up. They took their kids to school that day, but they waited outside. They wanted to see if indeed it would be their school that was integrated. That was kept secret. They knew it was going to happen that day, but they really did not know which schools were going to be integrated. And so when I showed up after the federal marshals had rushed me inside of the building, all of the parents that were standing outside protesting, they rushed in behind me. And as I sat there in the principal's office waiting to be assigned to a class, they would pass the window where I was sitting and they would point at me and shout and scream. And their faces looked really angry about something, but I had no idea what that could have been. And the next thing that I witnessed is that when they passed back by the window, there were kids with them. Well, what really happened is that they rushed into every classroom and they removed their kids. So over 500 kids walked out of school right before my eyes, and it was because I was there. The school emptied out right in front of me, and they never came back.
Unbelievable. And you spent the whole day in the principal's office, right, that day?
That day, I spent the whole day in the principal's office. Finally, the bell rang. The school was empty. Federal marshals put me back into the car and escorted me home. My mom said that that is the day that she was the most nervous, because she then turned her television set on and she could see that the whole country was watching it. And so the next day when the federal marshals arrived, I got into the car with them. And when we turned the corner on the second day, the crowds had almost doubled in size. People from all across the city showed up to protest. And they were screaming and shouting and they were throwing things. And on some occasions they would bring a baby's coffin, a real baby's coffin, and they put this black doll inside of the coffin. And I would have to pass the coffin to get inside of the building. They didn't bring it every day, but on the days that they did, I remember that that's what frightened me the most. I used to have nightmares about the coffin. But on the second day, when I got inside of the building, it was dead quiet. You could hear a pin drop. It was empty. And the federal marshals escorted me to a classroom. And the door opened and this woman stepped out and she said, "Hi, my name is Mrs. Henry. I'm your teacher." And I remember looking at her and thinking at that moment, she's white, because I'd not seen a white teacher before. Over at my old school, everybody looked exactly like me. So this was really my first encounter with a white teacher. And not to mention, she looked exactly like the crowd outside. But, you know, she said, "Come in and take a seat." And I remember looking into this empty classroom, nothing but empty desk. And I remember thinking, my mom has brought me to school too early. And indeed, we were too early, years too early. But I went in and I took a seat and she began to teach me. And I soon realized that even though she looked exactly like the people outside, that she was nothing like them. She was the nicest teacher I ever had. She really tried to fill my day with things to do that would keep my mind off of what was happening outside. And you could hear them screaming and shouting from the windows. You know, she would say, oh, we're going to have music today. And she would turn up the music so that we wouldn't hear them. And they were chanting 2, 4, 6, 8. We don't want to integrate. I remembered that because it rhymed, you know, being 6. I didn't even know what the word integrate meant. So, you know, in the evenings when I would get back home, my sister and I would jump rope to that 2, 4, 6, 8. We don't want to integrate. That was the innocence of a child. And I often say that that's really what protected me through that, that I knew nothing about racism. And it's important that all of us understand that each and every one of our babies, when they're born, they come into the world with a very unique gift. And that is they have a clean heart, a fresh start in life. You know, seeing Mrs. Henry and understanding that she looked like the people outside, but she was not like them at all, helped me to realize that we must allow ourselves an opportunity to get to know one another, not to look at each other and judge before we allow ourselves an opportunity to get to know each other. And it is the very lesson that I carry with me everywhere I go. It shaped me into who I am today. I honestly understand that we do ourselves such a disservice if we don't allow ourselves the opportunity to get to know each other.
Absolutely. And how were your parents reacting at the time that this was going on? Because their lives were impacted as well.
Yes, and it was very difficult for them because even my grandparents, who were still living in Mississippi on the farm where they had sharecropped for years and raised their own families, they were asked to leave the farm. The people there in Mississippi came to realize that it was their granddaughter that was in school causing all of this problems, they said. So they had to leave their farm and they moved from Mississippi then to Louisiana. My father lost his job. He was a service station attendant where he actually worked on cars, and his boss said, oh, all of my customers know it's your daughter and you have to leave. So he was fired. He was no longer able to provide for his family because the NAACP said it was too dangerous for him to go out and look for more work. So that was very, very hard for them. And I'm pretty sure it caused a lot of tension between my mom and dad. It was dangerous. You could not come onto the street that we lived on unless you showed identification. You had to actually live on the street. So it really inconvenienced the community and the neighborhood. But there were lots of people who supported my parents and my family throughout that.
And did it settle down after that kind of, you know, hugely intense period when you first started? What happened afterwards?
The worst part about first grade for me was the loneliness. I mean, the most important thing to any six-year-old is having friends, someone to play with. And I remember hoping that some kids would show up every day. Every day once I arrived, I would hope that there would be kids there, and it never was. And I was never allowed to have lunch in the cafeteria because they were constantly making all kinds of threats out in front of the school. They would say, oh, we're going to hang you, we're going to poison you. And so the federal marshals, they heard those threats and they took their jobs very seriously. So they met with my parents and said, you should prepare lunch and she should eat it at her desk because it's too dangerous for her to have lunch in the cafeteria. I mean, their job was to focus on my safety. So and even if I had to go to the restroom, the federal marshals would take me to the restroom and they would bring me back to my seat. So I remember at some point in time thinking that I was punished, but I couldn't figure out why. there were some parents, some white parents, who tried to cross that same mob of people to bring their kids to school, but they were never protected by federal marshals like I was. There's some archival footage that we found where you could see those parents being attacked by the mob. Principal, who was part of the opposition, she would take the kids and she would hide them so that they would never see me or interact with me. But there were days when I could hear voices of kids. I never saw them, but I could hear them. And I was constantly asking Mrs. Henry, my teacher, about them. I would say, Mrs. Henry, I hear kids. And she would never really say anything to me, but later we found out that she was going to the principal and saying, you're breaking the law. The law's now changed and kids are supposed to be together, but you're hiding them from Ruby. If you don't allow them to come together, I'm going to report you to the superintendent. And so that forced them to allow Mrs. Henry to take me to where the kids were. And that only happened a couple of times. And once I got there, there were four or five kids. And I remember being so excited to finally see them because I felt like I'd finally found friends. But indeed, that too was very heartbreaking for me because that's when a little boy said, I can't play with you. My mom said not to play with you because you're a nigger. And when he said that, it really helped me to put all the pieces together that it was because of me and the color of my skin. It really made sense now that he said that. So I then understood why all of the people were outside and why they seemed angry. But it wasn't until he said it. Yeah. So really that was my first real encounter with racism. It wasn't so much the crowd, it was really him and what he said and how he made it make sense to me.
Yeah. Gosh, that sounds, I mean, that's just awful. And then what happened after that? How did you feel about school and how did you manage for the rest of elementary school?
This is really strange to say, but I almost felt relieved because I no longer had to try to figure out what was happening around me. And yet when he said to me, I can't play with you, my mom said not to. In my six-year-old mind, I thought he was explaining to me why he couldn't play with me. And I was thinking, well, if my mom had said not to play with him, because he's white, or he's Indian, or Asian, or Hispanic, I would not have played with him. So it almost made sense to me that, okay, you know, I understand. So it was very lonely that year. And I remember, you know, Mrs. Henry came from Boston to teach me because teachers actually quit their jobs. They did not want to teach Black kids. And so she actually came from Boston to teach me. By the time school was over, the crowds were still out in front of the school. The crowds got smaller near the end of the year. Finally, it was summer vacation and I went home. And when I came back for second grade, I expected Mrs. Henry to still be there. I was no longer escorted by federal marshals because the crowds were gone. I remember going straight to the classroom, excited about school, because I loved school. She made school so much fun. You know, that whole year she and I spent together, neither one of us ever missed a day of school. So I was excited to go back. And when I went back, she was gone. She was no longer there. No one said anything about where she went. I then found myself in a regular classroom with about 25 other kids. There were a few other Black kids that looked like me in the class, but still more white kids. I found myself being taught by one of the teachers who had refused to teach me the year before. So second grade was, it was worse for me than first because my best friend was gone, Mrs. Henry.
And did you ever find her? Did you ever find her again?
Years later, 30 years later in 1995, when that first book was published, The Story of Ruby Bridges, that book actually brought us together again. And we were reunited on the Oprah Winfrey Show. It was very just unbelievable to me to finally be reunited with her all over again. Because I did have questions that I had been in my mind forever, not knowing whether I dreamed all of that or if those things really happened. And being able to connect with her again and have the conversation about what happened in that room, she confirmed lots of things for me. So it was really like meeting a member of my family that I had been separated from.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories. So the next point on your list, which I think we're kind of getting to, is you've said embracing your story fully and embarking on your life's work as an adult.
Well, you know, for a very long time, I really felt like that whole incident was something that just happened on my street and in my community. And mainly because once I got into second grade, the crowds were gone. I think pretty much everybody in the city was embarrassed about how they treated a child and how all of this played out to the wider world, that no one really wanted to talk about it. My parents separated by the time I was in sixth grade. That, I'm sure, led to other problems between my parents and eventually led them to separate. So I was then being raised by a single parent, my mom. No one really talked about that incident. I really grew up thinking that it was just something that happened right there. Not until I was probably about 17 years old did I see the Norman Rockwell painting of me, a little Black girl, walking into the school. That Norman Rockwell painting depicted my walk. And I remember a reporter showing it to me and saying, "This is you." And that really helped me to understand that this incident changed the face of education in our country, and that it was a part of a much bigger movement. And once that happened, I think it helped me to understand how important my role was in history. I did not embrace that until I was then about 30 years old with a family of my own. All of a sudden, like most of us in our mid-30s, we start to look into our lives and say, are we really doing what we should be doing? Or is this meaningful work? And so I found myself in the very school that I integrated volunteering. That first book was published by my child psychologist who worked with me when I was 6 years old. And then he published the children's book. And that really thrust me back into the public eye. I think at that point, everyone who knew what had happened in New Orleans then came to realize that I was the same person in the Norman Rockwell painting. So then I was asked to promote the book, which took me into schools across the country. Disney noticed the story and they did a television movie. And so I think then I became a household name pretty much. And what I found is that kids really related to the kid in the picture and in the story. They saw a hero in this child. They've connected and embraced my story now for almost 30 years.
Yeah. And you started the Ruby Bridges Foundation.
I actually started it because the proceeds from that first book went directly in to my organization. And what I wanted to do is to start small after school programs, mainly for the kids that were now attending the school that I integrated. It was an inner city school, very run down, and I wanted to help save it in some way. And then, of course, in 2005, Hurricane Katrina hit, destroyed the school. Then my foundation took on the task of trying to restore it and put it on the historic registry. And so we did that. The government sent in monies, and the school is now been restored. Now there's kids in the school again. And so I feel like that defeats the purpose of why I went into the school to actually integrate it. Because I so believe that if we are ever to get past our racial differences, I believe that it's going to come from our children.
Right.
And that children need to be together. And the best place for them to do that is in schools. Mm.
I read this great story that you spoke about where you were talking in schools about racism. And there was a little girl who talked about M&Ms. Can you tell that story?
When I'm in schools, I'm always trying to convince them how important it is that racism has no place in their hearts and in their minds. And sometimes I take on the role as the opposition, where they have to convince me that I am wrong and that it's okay for them to be together. This little girl said, well, you know, you're wrong, because we're just like M&Ms. And I said, what do you mean? She says, well, we are all different on the outside, but when you bite into us, we're all the same inside. And I just thought that was such a great analogy. So I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. Now I know that you understand.
So let's move on to your next moment, which is meeting President Obama. And was this when he brought your painting, the painting of you, into the White House?
I was so excited because I really wanted to meet him. And I remember going, just being excited about that. And I wanted to take my own son with me because I wanted him to be inspired by this first African-American president. I had already been at the White House years before under the Clinton administration because I had received the Presidential Medal. So, you know, it was...
Nothing new for you.
Nothing new. And then I get there and, you know, the door opens and he walks through the door. And then it hit me that, oh my goodness, he's Black. There's a Black man in the White House and he is president. It's a very different feeling one-on-one. And so I extended my hands and saying, Mr. President, it's such an honor to meet you. And all of a sudden he puts his hands on both hips and he looks at me and he said, are you kidding me? I am getting a hug. And he throws his arms around me and gave me this hug and whispered in my ear and said, I cannot begin to tell you what an honor it is to welcome you into this White House under this administration. And as I looked over my shoulder, we were still embracing, and I could see the few people that were in the room starting to tear up. And that's when I realized that this meeting between he and I was really bigger than he and I.
Yeah, huge.
It wasn't just these two people meeting. It was the time, those two times coming together and all of the lives lost between us, all of the sacrifices people had made. That's really what it was about. And it was very, very moving. It took on a whole new meaning for me. And then, of course, we did view the painting together and he looked at it and I asked him what he thought the girls thought about it. And he said, I think that they see themselves. And he said, well, you know, it's fair to say that if it had not been for you all in this moment, I might not be here today. Mm. And so that meant a lot because it reminded me of how many shoulders we all are standing on.
You're now kind of part of this incredible image of Kamala Harris, and you, so it's the shadow of you as a child, and then Kamala standing next to you. How do you feel about that image?
Well, that too was a moment in time that definitely reminded me of that. You know, it makes you think about, you may not ever see the fruits of your labor, just as Dr. King and so many other people didn't see it. My own father, who, you know, passed away when I was 21, didn't see it. But that doesn't mean you don't continue the walk, that you don't continue the fight. We as women, really, we have to continue the fight, all of us, but definitely women. That's what that piece on the wall meant to me, because here's another woman that's now gone through the door because of all of those people who came before her. So very, very powerful. And it's a lot to stand back now as an adult and see it all unfold and know that there's something very powerful happening through you. There was a time when I really didn't know what my purpose was in life. And probably, you know, all of us go through that. But I really wanted to know what it was. And I, you know, felt like I went into my prayer closet and spoke to my maker and said, just show me what it is. I want to know what my purpose is in life. And, you know, just surrendering to that, then doors started to fly open. So that keeps me understanding that you are just a vehicle and that it's working through you. And I think all of us can be that vehicle. You just need to ask what your purpose is and be committed to it.
Let's talk about your book, because that was your final moment, was writing your book, This Is Your Time. Can you just tell me about what that book means to you?
I watched what everybody else saw last March when this young man lost his life. I shouldn't say lost it, that it was taken away from him right before our very eyes. And I just think that that was the straw that finally broke the camel's back. It was like enough, that so many people saw it. So many people probably couldn't believe their eyes, even though we had been experiencing this stuff and seeing, but now there it was. We were all locked down inside watching our television set and could not escape it. I felt like for the young people that saw it, that I had been talking to for over 25 years, they must have been asking themselves, well, this isn't what Ruby Bridges has been saying. And yet all of us was like, somebody say something. You know, we were waiting for some kind of leadership. Somebody to say something. And then we saw all of the protesting that started in this country and then spread across the world, to remind us of all of the injustices that's happening, not just here in the States and on our streets, but just across the world. And I wanted to say something and didn't know what to say or how to get that message out. And so I have a really good team behind me who said, you should write a letter. And so we worked on that letter and thinking that it would be published maybe in some newspaper, New York Times, USA Today. But then my publishers saw it and they wanted to publish it. And so that's what it was. It was just a letter to the young people, young peacemakers, I called them, that I wanted them to understand that what I had witnessed and what I was seeing happen in the streets reminded me of what I saw when I was 6 years old. And that I wanted them to understand that we had to go through that during the civil rights movement and that we came out better for it. And that probably this too, we have to go through, because we all know we are not where we want to be. We are not. And that it is going to be a fight to get there. It is a struggle. And I think it will always be. Somebody has to move and somebody has to do something. And to be able to do that, you have to be hopeful. So I will always, all of my life be hopeful. because I know there's nowhere else to go if I'm hopeless.
That is a beautiful point to end on. Miss Ruby Bridges, thank you so much. That was just phenomenal. And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com or our Instagram or our Twitter or Facebook or TikTok or LinkedIn. You name it, we're there for you. See you next time.